Today is October the 12th, 2010, and we're here to have a conversation with Professor John Subak Sharp. Good evening.
Good evening.
Can I ask you, first of all, when and where you were born, and was this your name at birth?
I was born in Vienna in 1924, on the 14th of February 1924, and my name, and I have the birth certificate here if you want to see it, it was Herbert Subak, S-U-B-A-K, and that's the family name. The Sharp came later, and I can tell you how this came about, but is this the right moment to tell you?
I was just asking you about the street where you live, John. Could you explain what it's called?
That is, Subakova is in Trebić. I never lived there, or at least one day, long after the war with the family. The street, shabby little street now, but still the main street in the what was the Jewish quarter, was called Subakova. Then the Nazis changed the name to some extent, totally away from it. Well, when later we'll come to that, when I joined the army, and at that time, this was in 1944, several other Jewish boys had volunteered at roughly the same time, and we were encouraged. We were suggested it would be better if we adopted an English name or a British name in case we were either captured or killed, and in our case it was particularly in case our parents were still alive. We didn't know that they had already been killed at that time. So my brother, who is, although he's younger, he had joined the army somewhat earlier, had also came to Scotland first, and that was the first time we came to Scotland. He came to Maryhill Barracks, and here he picked the name Sharp, which was very similar in certain ways, same number of letters and so on. And it was obvious to me that the only reasonable thing to do is to take the same name a few months after Gerald had been. The Subak I took back into my name before we got married, so that Subak Sharp starts from that moment onward. It's Subakova. So this is where the family had a business, which at that time was mainly involved with leather.
Second in the Jewish part of the town.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. The Jewish part is quite separate, the other side of the river to the main town.
Did all your family move to Vienna, or was it just your...
Well, my father moved to Vienna. My mother came from another part, actually from Vienna. They were... It's the Brühl family. And they got married after the war in 1919. They had a daughter who unfortunately died of peritonitis, I understand. There's quite a long small child before I was born, and she's buried there in the Brühl cemetery parts.
So tell us then, you came to here because you were part of the Kinder transport. Can you tell us how that came about?
Surely, yes. Things got worse and worse in Vienna, and you have enough information about that that I don't need to go into great details about that. And my mother became very frightened and worried about what would happen to the children. And she heard about a man whose name was Musikant, believe it or not, who unknown to us and who had helped other people, was interested in the refugee children's movement, apparently. And he found a family, or at least a married couple, who had no children. Their name was Peskin. He was David Peskin, and she was Dorothy. And they were Jewish. Jewish. I'm not sure whether Dorothy had become Jewish. Anyway, they didn't really know much about children, and particularly young 14 or 15-year-old children. But they put down these 50 pounds that had to be put down for each child to guarantee that the child would not become a burden to the British taxpayer. And we managed to get onto the Kinder transport, And so I left Vienna and my brother and I together, and in January the 10th, and we arrived in Harrishookhof, and we finally got on the 12th of January.
Well, no, I've got the letters. John was never followed up by any religious thing, no refugee thing. John was never followed up. In
that
fact,
it was after I'd gone to the farms.
No, actually, we have a thing from the refugee children saying they have no record of him, except that he has, of course, his candidate. These are the letters sent by a Mr. Musicant saying to Dear Mr. and Mrs. Peskin, enclosed, please find two photos as promised. If I hear anything further, I will communicate with you. Kind regards, yours sincerely, Simon Musicant. And this is sent on the 22nd of the 12th to Peskins. Then you come the letter from the Hampstead Garden Suburb Care Committee for Refugee Children in conjunction with the World Movement for the Rescue of Children from Germany, British Inter-Aid Committee. Right? Nothing else. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Peskin, 61 Audley Road, we are very grateful for the generosity you've shown in offering a home to Gerhard and Herbert Zuberg of Vienna 3, Paracelsusgasse. We would be glad if you would communicate with his or her parents, but ask you to be extremely careful not to mention anything about conditions in Germany or anything which might in the slightest degree annoy the German authorities. And the postmark on the envelope is 9:30 a.m. on January the 6th, 1939, and it came from Golders Green, and you left on the 10th. So John was never, ever, ever followed up. And there's a synagogue chambers, Norris Lane. We've never been able to contact them. No official Jewish thing. Are you with me?
Yes. Do you think they maybe mislaid your records?
No, mm.
They say the kinder transport people. The
But you've got a piece of paper that has my photograph.
Oh, yes.
My father was in. That's my father there as an Oberleutnant in the Austrian army. He was a cavalry officer. He was in Ulanen. Do you know?
Yes. We have a picture in the hall of him being decorated by the emperor in the field.
Oh, goodness. And how did these pictures survive?
Some of them, not all of them, but some of them were kept. Were kept by a, not related, but by marriage related, through my cousin's marriage related family. And they had a big box, including some of the things that my parents obviously stored there so that something would be done, because they had to leave. They were thrown out eventually. I heard it much later, of course, out of their flat, given 24 hours to leave the flat, move to another place where they stayed for a while. And then eventually they were transported. The Germans were very, very careful to document everything.
We
so
know,
I know exactly the date when the transport.
We know the number of the transport that they were taken on.
And
we know everything.
We know where it went to Riga, and they were abgemeldet from. You speak enough German to say abgemeldet from Vienna, and not yet neugemeldet. So, but in other words, what really happened, I found it much later out through my cousin. But they were sent in by train to Riga, stopped just before, and they had already graves, not graves, but the big ditches were prepared, and were all shot. And his parents were in a different transport a little bit later. And he tells me, and I did not know exact details of this, but they were meant to go to Itzbika. But they were gassed in the railway carriages, in the carriages that they were transported on.
And who was that?
That was our cousin.
Your cousins.
Apparently, where Sam got the name, and I can give you that, and their number, on a transport in early 42. My cousin's parents, who lived in the same house but then were parted, were transported also, have the information about that. But May, April, I think, of the same year, they were sent, my cousins, to Itzbika. That is known, that was a concentration camp. And so on. My parents were sent to Riga, and apparently on arrival, without going into the town at the railway, they had already dug the graves. That's what my cousin tells me. And the people were shot and burned. And there is no clear evidence of where my parents were. I wanted to go to Riga because my cousin knew Riga from before. Initially, he escaped to Riga, and that was fine. That was before this all happened. And he strongly advised me not to go because there was nothing there. There's apparently a small monument. Monument is the wrong thing, a note or something. Not where they were shot or something, but in the woods there where they shot other people. There were a lot of people shot. And that's, unfortunately, I have nowhere to go to know that my parents actually were murdered. I've got the date, I've got the good evidence, clear evidence, what transport they were on, and if you want that, I can find it, although it's difficult. It's from Austria, they actually sent it, and that's really all I had. And of course, there was no further letters, no card on arrival or anything like that. Just it all stopped, in, as far as I was concerned, in 42. Where people were murdered, and Riga and Itzbika, now Auschwitz and so on, are all on that for everybody to see if you want to see it, but without any explanation rather than...
In Vienna.
In Vienna, in the first district. It is in the area where the Gestapo building was there, so I'm told.
Were you interested in science when you were a little boy in Austria?
Not particularly, certainly not biological sciences, because we had a teacher in the gymnasium who was known as Wurzenseppel. I don't know if you can read it. It's sort of a, it's like calling somebody clodhopper. I mean, it's not a literal translation. It was totally uninteresting. He brought in a stuffed animal or so on.
And muttered.
Muppet. He had a beard, you're absolutely right. That's why he was called Wurzenseppel. So I had no interest, and I'm sure I would either have been a lawyer or would have been directed towards it, or medical.
But your, what did you say what your father did?
Engineer.
He was an engineer.
Not mechanical, building engineer.
Mm. More of a surveying engineer.
We're talking of almost a different century. Mm-hmm. Things have changed considerably since then. But he was building sugar beet factory. You know, they were extracting sugar from beets, and he was building Dürrenkrut and places like that. He was involved in building. But he was junior at that time, so he worked for a bigger outfit. And I don't know very much about it. I mean, he was a remarkable man in other ways. He was an engineer who rarely used a slide rule at that time. He did it in his head. He was an excellent mathematician. He taught me quite a bit at that time. I was not very good at Latin at school, you know. And this is almost just before Hitler came in and so on. And eventually my mother complained, so my father came to me. Now, he can't have touched Latin for 50 years at least. And he said, okay, he took Caesar's De Bello Gallico, he opened it at the fourth chapter, and never got there at all, and he translated. And so he spent the next hour or so with me with translating. By sheer accident, the next day, the Latin exercise that we had started one paragraph after where we started, and it did continue for another paragraph. And the Latin teacher said to me, I had a very good marker, said to me, I can't understand it. I thought you must have been copying from somebody else, but there was nobody sitting near you.
Going back to your Jewishness, because I don't think we've touched on that, it was the cause of all your troubles in the first place. Once you came to Britain, I think Barbara said before, you've always seen yourself as Jewish. Do you think that's because of what happened?
Sure. Because of that, and the family was Jewish. Mm. And my father, both my mother and my father were Jewish. Mm. And my father was not religious, so he went to the synagogue on three holidays, Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah. And actually, in the last year, just before Hitler came in, I was already getting bigger, you know, nearly old enough to go. I went with him and his brother to the Seitenstetten Temple. I don't know if you know it. It's the one that they didn't burn during the Kristallnacht. The reason they didn't burn it, because it was so built in that it would have set fire.
Destroyed a lot of the other houses.
Yeah. Anyway, so we never kept a kosher house, and he was pleased and proud of being Jewish, but he was not religious, and he was not really very much involved in Jewish affairs. Most of our friends were Jewish, but they were all very similar to us.
Did you know any of the people in Glasgow? Because like my mother-in-law was from Vienna, and I would say that her life was very much the same as
I ran away from that farm. I didn't tell you this.
So you came over to stay with the
Peskins.
Until about May.
So only for a very, very short time.
Very short time.
And then what happened?
I became a farm pupil or a farmer's boy, and I stuck it out for 1 year, and then I actually ran away from there.
He must have just been thrilled because you were cheap labour, I suppose.
That's me, that's my brother.
Was your brother on the same farm?
No. This is on the day that I was delivered there, and at that time everything seemed to be...
Gerald was 1 year younger, and he had one more year at Little Ealing Grammar School. And then they took him to Coventry to his uncle, who was a barrister and who was working as a labourer.
Initially as a butler.
Came over as a butler.
Did you have any contact with your parents after you came over?
We had letters. Initially, of course, the war hadn't started. Mm. Once the war started, it became very, very difficult. But by a roundabout way, and I don't remember the details of it, they knew somebody in one of the neutral countries, and they could write to them, and those people could then send the letter on. So we had 2 or 3 letters. Unfortunately, by that time, as I say, I was working very, very hard. They had 3 times a day milking. That means you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you got to bed at 10 o'clock at night. And they used 14. Me as much as they could. It was not a very happy situation. And we had some contacts for a little while, and then they ceased.
We have his mother's letters with various people writing round the edges.
Because my children don't speak German, so I tried to do it.
It upsets him terribly.
I got to the point where I felt I couldn't
Also, when she writes, she is mourning these boys. Mm-hmm. Now, she's a very upstanding woman from all that I know, but she was writing to my dearest, darling boys. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. And a lot of things in them was that Auntie so-and-so came, but they've moved house. Mm-hmm. And Auntie so-and-so wasn't actually by name that person, but you know, there's a lot in them. So it's quite difficult, but we have them all. But again, it's difficult to know this other person. They need translating. They need translating for my children. Mm-hmm. They know about them. They know all the history. They know all the stories. And the grandchildren... What? No, not Yiddish. What's
Courant,
the
Courant, you mean.
Courant.
What's that?
That's the German...
That's the Latin way of writing. I mean, the... And very. The German, which is all ugly, but it's... was called Courant. And of course, under Hitler, that was the way writing should have been done.
Was that right? He stopped using the Gothic script?
That's Courant.
I once stopped using it because once people had grown up and they'd done it, my mother always wrote in script that you can read very easily.
Good. When did you arrive here in Scotland and how old were you when you came?
Well, first of all, I did not arrive initially in Scotland, but in England with the kinder transport. I had been working for quite some time in agriculture as a farm labourer or farm pupil, whatever you like. I can enlarge on that later if you want me. In Scotland itself, the first time I came to Scotland was in 1944, in June, early in June 1944. after I'd been called up. I say called up because I'd volunteered in May. I had some problem in volunteering in May simply because I was in a reserved occupation and I had to say that I was a hay cutter. That was apparently not enough reserved, and so I got in. So I came here, and the first time in 1944, I spent 6 weeks being in general training in Maryhill Barracks, and from there, then after 6 weeks, I went to Colchester and joined the Ochsenbachslag Infantry, Light Infantry. If you want me to continue this aspect very quickly. Mm-hmm. And after a short time in there, I was there 3 or 4 months, the opportunity came to volunteer for special services. I volunteered both for commandos and the parachute regiment. The parachute regiment needed people at that time because they just lost a lot of people in Arnhem, I guess. Mm. But in any case, they called me first, and I became a paratrooper there.
Yes, and did you ever have to go out with a plane in battle? Did you have a chance of showing off your skills?
Not really, because the war was coming towards an end at that time. We were standing by, we were not used at that time, and then there came the European theatre disappeared. I had an opportunity initially, I thought I had one, but it didn't work out, to drop onto Norway at that time, so I was with the intelligence officer, and I was in the intelligence section of the Paris and at that time. And then we put aside the battalion, it was moved aside, moved to Ockham, amongst other things. And then we were going to go to the Far East. The Seaborne Party had already gone to the Far East at that time. And then the Japanese war came to an end. And for a short time, I was trying to learn enough Japanese to make sense of any maps that I could find. And instead of that, they decided to send us in the one theater where I did not particularly want to go, to Palestine. So we were sent to Palestine, and first up in the Gaza area, and then to Teletvinsky.
I was trying to find what Teletvinsky was called now, because we couldn't find it on the map, and actually we couldn't find it on old maps either.
Well, that was the name that I had. I was not there very long, but it was, I shall say, a British barracks is too good.
An outpost?
It's not an outpost. The outpost would be Gaza, because nothing much happened there. From there they went into Tel Aviv, for example. On one occasion, I was getting very angry at them, but that's beside the point. Mm-hmm. I didn't go on this, but they were all in favor. Bevin's policy was anti-Jewish and pro-Arab. You probably know that as well as I do. In fact, he made a statement at some stage to say that he would solve the problem. He didn't solve the problem, and he handed it then. He evacuated. There were lots of things, but Israelis will be able to tell you much more of the anti-Jewish policy. And it was only after they used to hang Irgun or fighters that they had caught and so on. And then Irgun got 2 British sergeants. They were actually intelligence sergeants, caught them, and they threatened that they would retaliate, which they did, and they hung these 2, which was a pity. But after that, the hanging of Jewish Irgun or other fighters stopped. There were a few Jewish boys in that, and when it became very obvious that, and the British powers, that they were really much more interested in siding with the Arabs there against, the Jewish boys were taken out of the unit and sent to Egypt to work in POW camps. And so the rest of my work was really in POW camps, again on interpreter and intelligence work, and identifying potential war criminals and so on. But it was all a waste of time. Britain had lost its interest in the war criminals. Their main interest was what was happening in Greece, where there was a big communist problem going on there. It was really largely a waste of time.
And what happened in the end to these people, the prisoners of war?
They were all sent back. Nothing happened. I took one group, okay, you asked something. Later, when I was stationed in Fayette and Fanar, I took one group to Port Said. And the reason was, these were all German spies. Now, I mean spies, who had, most of them, had been captured in Iran, or what was then Persia. Some of them were apparently civilians, German civilians. Others were from the, up there was the army.
Is it the regular army?
Yes, but there was the SS and the Gestapo and so on, and there up there was the military side of it that had been captured. So there were all sorts of individuals that were there. It's really incredible. I had the job to take them in a lorry, 10 or 12 of them, with a couple of squaddies with me through a lot of that to Port Said, to be sent back to the UK initially, but actually to be employed in Berlin, which at that time was the last thing I wanted to. The first people to be repatriated, to the best of my knowledge, from the worst people that I would have thought should have been hung. However, that was the job. I had my pistol there, and I don't think they ever had any intention of escaping at all. They knew that what was going to happen. They were going to be used for intelligence work against the Russian sector. I mean, all I did was make sure that they arrived at the other side with my two squaddies.
So say again, they were going to be used in intelligence...
Against the Russians?
Against the Russians, mm-hmm.
In Berlin. Mm-hmm. I think that's where they were finally... But I lost all further contact. I'm pretty sure that's where they were used.
It was interesting to some extent. And then my time was up, and I was released in 1947, in September 1947, with having reached the dizzy heights of war substances sergeant.
And what age were you then?
In 1947, I was 23.
And you see, you're a substantive sergeant. Is that right? Is there a word, substantive
war
sergeant?
War substantive. In other words, the regulars didn't have the war substantive. It meant that as soon as the war finished, as far as they were concerned, the rank could be reduced or changed.
Right.
Because of money, but it was nice at least to have the war substantive, which means once there was a war. But that was irrelevant. That rank was arrived at on extra regimental duties. I hope you have got there, because it was extra regimental duties in prisoner of war camps. The prisoners of war were German prisoners of war who had been captured mainly in the Aegean area. There were all sorts, and if you want me to enlarge slightly,
yes,
on that.
Please.
There were hardliners, that was hardline Nazis, that had already been identified by the time I get the majority of them. Then there were people that were involved, but in some cases involved in war crimes, which were of various different types, and that had been elucidated by other people who had earlier interrogated them, but couldn't easily be proved. So they were lower category. So they were C's or B's. C-plus was the real hardcore. The B's were non-political almost, and the A's were clearly totally non-political, and they were usually quite young. And some of the clerics that we employed were mainly, at least that I employed, were all A's. So the A, they were nearly my age, or very close to it, and there was no clear political problem. I should enlarge a bit more on that. I served in two different prisoner of war camps, That was because the Jewish people in the parachute regiment were sent out of Palestine, the majority, except those who protested and wanted to serve there, and there were very few. I don't know, they could say they wanted to stay with the regiment in which they always were. Well, I didn't have much choice, and it never even occurred. So they were sent out. There were, in my unit, there were maybe between 6 and 10 out of the 400 or 500 people that we were, a small group. And earlier, before we went to Palestine and so on, I was in the I section, that was the intelligence section of the unit. There I was a private. Again, if you want me to say a bit more, I'm very happy to, but it may not be relevant. Because eventually I left the I section when the war had finished, and just before the war had finished, we were due to drop probably on the Japanese mainland, the whole unit. And I learned for a very short time, learned is the wrong word because I've forgotten most of it, to identify Japanese regiment units, so that from maps, if we got some maps, we were meant to read it. Total waste of time. I couldn't do anything of this sort. Now, our seaborne party, that means the party to accept the regiment, prepare things for it, had already gone out to India. We were still training in Britain, but the war then finished. That was after the Japanese surrendered. So Bevin decided to send the unit to Palestine, where there were real problems. Mm-hmm. That was the last place I wanted to go to. I actually spoke to Captain Bengeli. He had been a captain in the Paris. The name Bengeli is Cornish, I think. Anyway, he persuaded me that I'd been in the unit and he would be prepared to try to help me to look for my parents. But I really should show some esprit de corps, and decided I'd been part of the unit for some time, so I didn't insist on trying to get to Europe after the war.
So was it when you were 23 and released, did you come back to Scotland or stay in England at that point?
No, I went to England, I went to Birmingham. I had decided for some time that I ought to do something positive rather than pretty negative things. And I needed to get back to the educational level that I expected, or that I should say that my parents would have expected me to reach. When we were demobbed, my brother and I were together and came together again at that time. He incidentally had been earlier, and he was sent to OCTU, Officers Training Corps, and he just made that at the end of 45, or just so. Neither of us actually, he was in the Royal Warwicks, and neither of us actually did anything really useful during our army careers.
I was under the impression that you had to be in a Jewish brigade. As somebody coming from abroad, you were allowed to serve.
At that time, yes, absolutely.
Because it was later in the war then?
That was later in the war, it was 44, and there was no question about that.
That's interesting. Then after the war ended, what happened?
When we came out, both of us wanted to get our university education. My brother, who had been doing his matriculation and his hires in Coventry, because we had been quite separated, whereas I was on the farm, he got an FETS grant, further education and training grants. In my case, it was refused because I'd been in farming and I'd not been studying, apparently, at that time. So I got nothing from that. However, my brother and I, for the first year, shared, actually, his grant. But then he went to University College London, whereas I had set my matriculation, his mature matriculation, both of us had to sit mature matriculation, into Birmingham University. So they had to offer me a place. So after the first year, I got a grant from Birmingham itself. I also had some help from the family, Mr. and Mrs. Peskin, who are dead now, who had actually guaranteed for us children when we first came over as children, aged at that time 14 and 13. So I got a grant from Birmingham, not from the university, but from the city. And from then onwards, we went slightly separate ways. There were two things that I should say. First of all, going back early to when we first came over in England, we were both going to be interviewed by educational psychologists. We had, of course, done no educational work at all for the last year in Vienna after Hitler came and we were thrown out of our school. And this was nearly a year later. And this man had obviously been educated beyond his intellectual capacity. And he decided we were not worth educating. That is how I actually was interested in farming, and I was not sent to a farming college, but to work as a pupil on a pretty dreadful farmer.
How did he decide you weren't worthy of educating?
He tried to interview me in Latin. He said, I see you have done Latin for at least a couple of years and so on. Now, I don't know whether you have done Latin at all, but certainly not colloquial Latin.
No.
I obviously could not possibly hold an interview in Latin. That's the way it goes. A second time, almost the same thing happened to us when we got into Birmingham University, potentially into Birmingham University, because we had taken this mature matriculation into the university itself. There was a man, that admissions tutor, I don't know if I should mention his name, but okay, his name was Dr. Ibs at that time. Major Ibs, he called himself, because he was something in the territorial army, but he had not done very much elsewhere. He was an awful lecturer, he lectured in heat. However, he interviewed us, he offered me mining engineering, in which I had absolutely no interest whatsoever. And he offered Gerald, my brother, a year below what he could already enter in, because Gerald had taken an intermediate just before joining the London Intermediate. I had learned matric, but that didn't make... We both didn't accept this. Eventually, he had to offer something else. He offered me the botany and biology, and then from then onward, it went on. But he said, you would have been better off if both of you had failed. He obviously didn't like refugees, or at least like... Don't forget, we were young men then. We were experienced. We had been living for quite a long time in the army and made reasonable progress there. When I got to Birmingham University, as I said, the first years had to be shared, but I got lectures from a brilliant lecturer, not a very pleasant man, but brilliant lecturer in genetics. And I decided when he asked me to go into the first year in genetics there, which would be the third year at the university. Yeah. I took some time, then they said yes. And eventually I graduated with first-class honours in genetics.
And you got first-class honours, and I believe that was the first degree in single genetics.
First. The others got two, as far as I remember. This was a relatively small class, but mainly second. I don't remember what everybody... There was no other first. There was no other first that year in the whole biological sciences. So that was botany, zoology at that time, and genetics. I was the only one. The year before, there were two firsts, but not genetics. They were... As far as I remember, both in zoology, or one in zoology, one in botany. Firsts were very hard to get in those days.
Very rare. And you decided then to go into academic
I was offered
work.
Then to, and again there had to be an interview, I was offered
to do a PhD in the Birmingham University with Martha or that small group of lecturing staff there, and had to go to London to be interviewed, and I got an Agricultural Research Council scholarship, which was as good as you can get. That was £300 a year, tax-free. I'm mentioning this to you because actually later on I had a letter from the inspector of taxes saying, why had I not registered? And I said, my award is tax-free. We had several letters going which ended up from the inspector of taxes. It appears that your ARC grant is tax-free. No apology or anything.
Sorry, say the name of the grant, the type of grant. The grant was called the...
ARC's Agricultural Research Council. Studentship.
And did that mean that you had to specialise in one particular area?
Oh, yes. I had to do it with Martha and Rhys and a couple of other people. But I was really not much supervised, but that's beside the point. You can see my PhD thesis if you want to.
And what was it on? What was your subject?
I specialized. I managed to isolate unusual Aspergillus is a fungus from the top of a Marsala bottle cork. And it turned out to be very interesting, and I developed that. So really, I could have stayed in that subject if I wanted to. But at the same time, I had my own problem there, but at the same time, the problem I was given is to investigate heterothallism in wild Aspergillus. That was an interest in the place. And I did that too. So I had two parts of the thesis. My prof said at the time that I was gilding the lily, whatever that means. But it really hooked me onto research. The fact that I didn't have a supervisor. I had a supervisor nominally, but he was on a external leave in Scandinavia with Winge. Winge was a yeast pathologist, so I really had no supervision.
And thereafter, what happened, John? Where did you go next?
Let me try and say this. I had a number of... Once I got my PhD, no, before I got my PhD, I was attracted by one of the competitors, so I still was writing it up, and the competitor was in Glasgow. So I went, after 2 years in Birmingham with no supervision, I went to Glasgow with no supervision, but I was now an assistant, really assistant lecturer, but it was called as, with Pontecorvo here in Glasgow. And I wrote up, I was married after the first year of my PhD work, still in Birmingham. I was to Barbara. We've just had our 60th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
I'll show you. We're headed in the teeth of opposition from her mother.
She didn't approve of you, did she?
I was a refugee, a Jew, penniless, as far as they were very... very poor. And she didn't approve. You can ask Barbara, she'll give you an even better description. However, it worked out okay. We were saying, after 2 years, we came to Glasgow. Barbara worked in the, she was a nurse, and Barbara worked in the Queen Mother's, I think, for a short time. Then we had, at the very end, while I was finishing my PhD thesis and to submit it to Birmingham, of course, we had our first child, our eldest child. And so he was born just before we left again from here. And I dipped his foot into Loch Lomond just...
True Scot.
This is no, to remind him where he was. I went into Perth. I was given the opportunity to become something new for them, a geneticist in Purbright. Mm-hmm. And this is where I switched to viruses. Mm-hmm. And worked on foot and mouth disease virus. And I worked in Purbright. I had an assistant and started genetics of FMDV, foot and mouth disease virus. Do you want me to go on or not?
Yes, please.
So, well, I was in Purbright. We had a house there that was provided. When we came in, it was a brand new house, and there were 7 different leaks from room. But they had an organization to put that right. And I worked there. Let me try and see. Mainly foot and mouth, but I became a senior worker there. I became one of the senior we were called research officers, mm-hmm. and so on. And then, I'll make it quick because it's, as I said, I started in genetic section. Then Michael Stoker, who has just died, asked me to come up from Purbright to give a lecture to his new staff. He had just started virology here in Glasgow. He was good friends with Pontecorvo, mm-hmm. and it's quite clear to me that Pontecorvo, who was a wonderful person as a person and a very good scientist, had obviously recommended this, because I had the flu when I came up, and I gave this lecture streaming, and Stoker then asked me to come to his office, which he did, and he said he won't beat about the bush. He was wanting to offer me a position there. Immediately, I said, that's impossible. I said, I have just obtained a visiting scientist of a professorship, I think it was visiting scientist it was called, position for the next 6 months with Renato Dal Becco. Dal Becco won the Nobel Prize subsequently, and not thanks to me, but thanks to his work in California, at California Institute of Technology. And I had a grant to it, so that was okay. And Stoker said, that's okay. You'll have this as a sort of sabbatical leave before you even start. I don't remember his exact words, but he obviously wanted me there. And the MRC will take over the grant from the ARC itself. The grateful people in Purbrad, I was just about to be promoted, stopped that promotion in Purbrad again, but asked me to appoint a replacement for myself. So I appointed the next Jeanette. It's so funny, it's unbelievable. But you don't want
to. So who did you appoint then?
Pringle.
Ah, right.
Craig Pringle. And Craig Pringle eventually. Do you know?
My husband's talked about Craig Pringle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I appointed Craig Pringle.
So when you came back from Caltech.
Well, I appointed, I recommended. Mm-hmm. That was the only recommendation.
And then, so you were 6 months in Caltech and then you came back to Glasgow?
Yes, it may have been slightly longer than 6 months. It was more. It may have been up to 8 months. I came back, but I was poor. I was still on a British grant in America at that time, which was not very good. And I sent back Barbara and the children. But at that time we had just two Purbright, where we had been before, until I would come back. And so I came. When Dalbeco found out how poor we really were, he suddenly got me an extra $500, which was quite a bit per month. But then Barbara just left, so it's a peculiar left at the point. And then I came to Michael Stoker. I did not go to the university. I went to the virology unit. He was both professor of virology and director of the MRC unit. So I was now in MRC from ARC, mm-hmm. Agricultural Research Council.
To the Medical Research.
Medical mm-hmm. Research Council. And the work went pretty reasonable here. And then but I was MRC.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had made a couple of discoveries which relevant at the moment, but well, I won't go into that. And I was asked whether I would like to come to Siegmüller to do some of the work. This was with cells rather than anything else, and come as a sort of visiting professor at that time. It wasn't really a visiting professor, but it was really doing research at NIH, that is the National Institute of Health in Bethesda. And I then came, and then Stoker, I was out, I had gone out there to do this, because when Michael Stoker was resigning and was retiring into the ICRF, there were four senior scientists, of which I was one, who did not know what was going to happen. Mm. And there were so many rumors, and what Stoker offered all of these a position there. Now the Latin still somewhere here. He was very good, really. Mm-hmm. And I would have gone to him.
And where was that? Sorry.
This was in 1968.
And where was he?
Oh, he was here. He was still, but he had accepted. He had accepted the position of in London. Become research director in the Imperial Cancer Research Fund, ICRF. He offered me that position, and it would have been a good position. Earlier, he had been offered a chair in Oxford, and when he was offered that, he consulted us, but we would not have the laboratory facilities were very limited, so we would not have had much advantage of uprooting there without that, and we none of us, or I can't speak for all the others, but probably did not feel that. They could go accept this place, though. So he refused the Oxford one. And then accepted the ICRF one. This time, of course, he could offer us a lot more laboratory space. And the others, really, Crawford and McPherson went with him, and stayed there. And I suddenly got him. I went out to seek Miller, and then I had a call. The principal of the university would like to interview me. Don't forget, I was not a university. So I came back. And strangely enough, as soon as I came back, Barbara can tell you that, there was this was in December, just after Christmas, just then, there was a letter, or she had information, I don't know if it was a letter or not, saying the interview is off. But I arrived to get that information, so just went to bed after flying the Atlantic and so on, being at last with my family. And then a few days later, the interview was on again, and I was offered the position of that Stoker had. In other words, the position of now full professor in the university, responsible for the department, and more important, really, the director of the whole Institute of Virology, which included the MRC Virology Unit, which was a big research institute by then, in a building, believe it or not, that building had been built by the same person that built the Coventry Cathedral, the architect. Anyway, I'm reminiscing, and I shouldn't do that. But that's how I came.
Yes.
And then I was stuck.
Right.
And I held that position until I retired in 94, from 68 to 94.
So tell Claire and I a little bit as well about the SIBA medal, because I don't think we kind of noted it down properly last time. So the SIBA award...
It, It's strange.
And we have a photograph of it.
You've got the photograph, okay. It was just for the various bits of research, mm-hmm. or research thing that I'd done and established. There's also something else which I almost feel should not have been done. Not this evening. This was the International Herpes Virology Commission instituted a lecture which mm-hmm. is in my name, but that shouldn't have been done till I was safely dead.
No, I don't think so.
It's nice you know about it.
Hmm?
It's good that you know about it.
Well, you couldn't help know it, because this is an annual thing. And as far as I know, until at least a year ago or so, there was still enough money to have it. So it was, it's been going for a long time. I mean, they just appoint somebody. Mm-hmm. I have nothing to do with it anymore. And they gave me a golden whistle. Did the barber tell you that?
I thought that was wonderful. But I was going to ask, is the lecture held in the same place every year?
No, in different mm-hmm. places. Wherever the international meeting takes place. Mm-hmm. During my time, mm-hmm. I ran these meetings in several places. One of them in Cambridge. Another one in Edinburgh. Most of them are in other places, either in Italy or France,
mm-hmm.
and in the States, mm-hmm. quite a lot of them in the States. So I've become reasonably accepted.
I think highly accepted.
And your golden whistle, what was that representing?
I was astonished. When I retired, you haven't seen it, have you?
No. Show it to us afterwards. Tell us about it first.
I can't tell you anything except that I was so astonished to get it. So I tried it and it works.
And it was from your research in herpes,
from the international community. Strangely enough, that's the first time, as far as I know, that this was done. But it says from the international community, but they didn't put my name on it.
Well, you better not lose it then.
Well, I can sell it now. No, it was astonishing. They also supported a visit by Barbara, had been very ill at that mm-hmm. time. We had a ship's tour to Alaska from it. The last meeting that while this was done was in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
and to Alaska. That's the only time I've been to Alaska. It was quite nice, and it was in a cruise ship, simply and solely, because Barbara was not very well, and it was very important that there would be mm-hmm. a doctor there. She didn't need it as it is, and so we, at different places where we stopped, we flew on to Glacier. The sort of life that I never enjoyed and didn't know quite how to handle it, but it was okay.
Now, I better say this is
Barbara,
John's wife, Barbara.
Right. So the two boys were at two different technical colleges trying to get their exams, and I was at Birmingham Technical College. John was at Aston, which eventually became the University of Aston. And it turned out that I was sitting with, I can remember an Irish girl, I can't remember what her name was at all. I was sitting with this girl, and it appears we were chatting. She was very talkative, and it turned out John was sitting
trying to read calculus,
actually, and remember the book itself, Calculus Made Easy by Sylvanus P. Thompson, and two girls came in, and they were chatting continuously. They sat behind me. You know, it wasn't very full. And so eventually I turned around and said, for God's sake, shut up. And that's how I met my wife.
That's an unusual chat-up line,
that's,
I think.
That's right.
Well, it wasn't a very long.
We weren't going out very long.
We were married
several years later
in August 22nd, 1953, which means 57 years we've been married.
Yep.
My mother disapproved very much. I married a student. I married a Jew, and I married a foreigner. Now, what on earth worse could you possibly do?
Mm. The opportunity came to try to get a job as a geneticist and so on. And I was encouraged to apply from different places. There were actually three different places. The first of these would have been in the West Indies. And your wife would have a servant at that time and all sorts of things like that. And the man who interviewed me had been a colonel in the past, and I was, of course, very delighted not to have anything to do with the army anymore. And then he suddenly looked at my CV and said, I see you were in the army. I admitted that that was so. Parachute regiment? Okay. You spent 3 years in this. What do you think of this army thing? I said, after the first year, when one got through all sort of interesting problems, it was a sheer waste of time. And you don't say that to a colonel normally. So the West Indies, we were not that interested. The second was in Sheffield, and the third was in Glasgow. When I went to Sheffield for interview, it was a dreadful day, thick fog, and I looked at it, and there were grey tulips. They were yellow, actually, but that I wasn't really too keen on Sheffield at all. However, there was no problem with the interview. But then I went to Glasgow, and here was Pontecorvo. Guido Pontecorvo was that time reader, and the type of research I was doing was in fungi at that time. And his department was mainly interested also in fungal genetics. He worked on a slightly different organism than the one I had, and he had done an enormous amount of work, but I was the only one who was working on my system, and it had gone well. Anyway, I got the job, and Ponte was a friend ever since, really, although I only spent 2 years with Ponte, and then was recommended at the time when I got my PhD that I should start the genetic sections in Pirbright, which was Foot and Mouth Disease Research Institute, and I went to Pirbright. Pirbright in Surrey.
How long were you looking at foot and mouth?
I was working in the foot and mouth disease from 56. I left from Pontecorvo, who was genetics in Glasgow. I went to Pirbright. And I was there for about 4.5 years. I went then for a relatively... Okay, I went from there to California, to the California Institute of Technology, to work with Renato Dal Becco, who's since then... He was a wonderful man to work with, but he got the Nobel Prize later. But it's not relevant, except it shows you there was some quality there. And before, when I still was in the Foot and Mouth Disease Institute, because Michael Stoker, my predecessor, led, and Pontecorvo were very friendly and working together, Ponte must have told him that if he wanted a geneticist, that this was probably it. And I was offered a position there. I said, I am now committed to go to California for a while. He said, well, you can start like on that as a sabbatical. So I had a sabbatical before I ever worked for the MRC.
Can I ask you a little about your experience as a refugee? When you came up to Glasgow, did you mix with other people who'd had to escape Germany?
Yes.
Or even before that? Did you
mean when I first came out?
You were only here for 6 weeks, so no, yes. no. I mean,
the no, six, there were no, several. Yeah. Oh. There were several at that time, and really? At least one or possibly two. I don't remember exactly. Also, eventually, I met again in Paris. When I say met again, simply and solely because we were once we left here, we went to different units, and I'm sure I was the only one who went to the Ochsenbach's Light Infantry. The last employer, farming employer, was very, very helpful in any ways.
He'd already had your uncle as a butler.
Yes, and he could have stopped me of coming by saying he needed it, and it was a reserved occupation. You couldn't argue with this. He was very helpful, he understood, and I've kept in contact till he died with him and his wife. In fact, while I was farming there, this was the better times, in the evening I played bridge with them.
Yeah, no, I think I wanted a little more, because I know that when we first met you, it was through the Sarok. So was there a gap when you were here and you weren't mixing with any other refugees and then you met them again?
No,
once
I was working, and I really had very little else. That, incidentally, Glasgow University had at least three, I think it was four, professors.
Who were kindertransport. That, I think, is incredible.
I know, that is amazing. So that's you, Professor Hutter.
That's right.
Izzy Metzstein.
Oh, Izzy.
Izzy right. Metzstein.
And who's the... Overton.
He's died.
Oh, yes, Carl Overton, who died recently.
What was Carl Overton's...
Chemistry.
Career? Chemistry. Yeah.
That is quite remarkable.
Did you know any of the people when you came to Glasgow and came along to any of the meetings?
When I first came up, just to join the forces, the Glasgow people
gave hospitality.
I've forgotten what the name of the place was. Hospitality to Jewish recruits, if you like to put it. And I went to that with two or three others, and we were very hospitably treated. We met some of the younger people, but we never... Being there only for 6 weeks, and 6 weeks in Glasgow at that time, which is winter time now, fogs. I don't know if you remember Glasgow.
Black.
So the people were friendly, but also the non-Jewish people were friendly. For one penny, you could go anywhere on the trams, and the conductresses often refused to take your penny, because they knew they were getting very little. So that was very reasonable, very happy. But I never kept up with any of them.
And later you met, did you meet through Sarok people again? When you joined Sarok, did you meet other people at that stage or not really?
That I had seen, met before? No.
I don't
forget, so many years have gone in between that probably most of them have gone somewhere else.
I can remember going to a lecture when we first came up, when we came up with B'nai B'rith. And I can remember...
Wasserstein was one of them.
Oh, yes, of course, the Wassersteins lived very close to us for that very short time. Mm-hmm. And my children, they gave us a lot of baby clothes. We were absolutely nothing. So for years, my children's dolls were wrapped in a blanket, little square blanket, with BW in the corner. So there he is. And... But we unfortunately should have kept it, shouldn't we?
And have your sons kept that Subak Sharp?
Yes. They're both consultants now. And yes, Subak Sharp. His daughters, his son also is Subak Sharp. He has twin daughters. And they, although they married, got new married names, have taken the Subak into their name. I was on a visiting committee that were involved in cancer research in the main. It was a British-Czech combined, and we started in Prague, and I happened to be sitting opposite another man called Alexander, who was also, I think, Jewish professor, speaking to one of their leaders on the Czech side, who was a minister, as far as I know. The Czechs had two ministers, I think. One was Slovak and one was Czech at the time. And he just asked me whether I had any connections. So I said, yes. Where to? So I said, my father was born in Trebić, but I've never been there. So he said, okay, I'll make sure that you go there and visit during this joint visit
between British and Czechoslovak scientists who are interested in various aspects of cancer research, which incidentally, the British leader was Michael Stoker, who had been John's my predecessor. And so that's the first time I went, and I've been a number of times.
91 keeps crossing the Atlantic, was here 2 or 3 weeks ago. 91.
The family has been very close. And
I was going to ask, which I know hasn't anything to do with questions, but I was just, I was admiring the photograph of your
Robert.
Award. It's John and you. Uh-huh. So when was that taken?
What is that? That looks very impressive.
That's the CBE.
You have some
for
photographs
God and the Empire.
Of the Queen.
Because
yes,
we interrupted your history of
that's
what
John
happened.
And Lizzie.
So let's go back to foot and mouth. There must have been something that led from foot and mouth research to getting the CBE.
I held the chair and the directorship together. They were really separate things for 26 and a half years. And
but also who's on
after about
government.
20 odd or so. This was in, when was it? 91?
I don't think I've ever seen a CBE. It's
no,
lovely looking. The blue is beautiful.
Look how, what a good looking man, what a good looking boy my husband was. Don't you think?
I noticed that. I thought he was very handsome. And blonde hair.
Oh, right. Well, you can see the grandmother with the blonde hair on the landing.
I was very blonde, but of course one turns pink as one gets older.
There you are. You see, you have various government appointments and things.
So this is the Biochemical Society?
That's really quite... That's the Sieber Medal. There's only one awarded each year. Can I turn it around to you? You'll see it's more attractive on the other side.
Very
could
nice.
Almost be a Jew. His name was Misha. He might have been.
And why were you awarded...
He started DNA.
Why were you awarded
right.
the Sieber
isolated
Medal?
The chemical.
What would you say was the highlight of your working career?
Highlight, it was really to in considerable competition at that time to be picked by Hemsworth as the future director when Michael Stoker, my predecessor, took over the Imperial Cancer Research Fund. And I was picked and given that opportunity despite of the fact that there were several other people who were
three others.
More British than I, so you say highlight. I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed the work I did on nearest neighbor analysis. This is where you analyze DNA, RNA, by transferring one atom from one to the nearest neighbor and then identifying which are the different letters that follow one another. I did quite a bit there, and that gave me some reputation elsewhere. I did quite an interesting work much earlier than that. I did, when I was with Pont initially, I really discovered some non-nuclear inheritance, extra-nuclear inheritance in fungus. That would have been my career normally if I hadn't suddenly had a wife, a child, and the opportunity came to start something quite different in viruses about which I knew very little at that time when I started. Other things were isolating some of the first mutants of herpes simplex virus, still with my hands, which was very important. And suddenly finding that I was beginning to get an international reputation. I didn't publish very much.
Probably because you were so busy actually working.
That's right.
Even if I say this myself, I was fairly generous in starting something and then handed it over to others. But I felt that that was the right way of going about it.
He never kept anything for himself. Other people
I was,
often got them.
To be elected to EMBO was really another hand. This European Molecular Biology Organization, very early during its time, and I did quite a lot of work for them. And amongst other things, I went on to one of their committees and then became the chairman of the workshop, course and workshop committee. I ran several workshops here in Glasgow, which was really very important because it seeded, so I got known quite well as seeded virology, in particular the genetics aspect of virology, which I did virtually throughout Europe. So that was
I like the way you sort of say very understated. That was, I think that's quite exceptional.
He worked for the horse race betting people. Well, okay, but I'm just going to say he did at some stage or other. And he was given hospitality by Lord Carnarvon. And so he went and saw the remains of the Tutankhamun bits in his that were there. And it was very interesting. And goes to the Jockey Club. I've even been to the Jockey Club. And, you know, the game's not worth the candle. So you had to pay for your candle on your bridge table or your card table. And that game wasn't worth the candle. And the other thing is, of course, he had lunch with the Queen. And they talked about snotty noses. It's a horse disease.
I lost out on that one. Because this
didn't
was at St. James Palace, she came. We had very nice lunch with a very good wine that was there, and I was in the queue standing on it, and Carnarvon came up to me and he said, "John, you should meet the Queen." So I was dragged out, saw everybody else continuing getting their wine and so on, went to speak to her. She talked about her problems and so on, and you can't really leave the Queen. Finally, she said, "Just talked to my vets and went to see a vet, and once off the leash, so to speak,
you raced back for the wine.
It's too late."
Exactly.
Oh, that's a sad story.
I think that would be a low point.
Yeah. No, but it was quite nice. It was interesting in itself to be on that committee that had quite a lot of money, but they ran out of money, so that stopped it, and that money that committee still had was handed over to the horse race betting levy board, and they went on.
But that very was very close to with Smith, Klein and Beecham. Yes,
that was quite interesting. Other highlights was
I think
running some of the herpes virus workshops was really
when he retired.
And I would have thought this Seba medal didn't.
Yeah,
and
that is a bit of silver.
So,
you know, that was a wonderful lecture because all the people who've been associated with him from all over the world, and there's a map up on the wall of the world where all the people who've been associated with him came, they were on the map.
They did me well.
And the principal at that stage was very nice. He said he always knew that when John Subbachshob had something to say, he said, "John always thought first and spoke afterwards." I can't remember the exact words, but it was very nice. And then later on, there was the last meeting of the herpes group, and this was in Vancouver. They presented him with a gold whistle. Now, don't laugh, but the whistle was the handover. You know, in a relay race, you hand over. Well, the whistle was always handed over to the next chairman. So this time
you started the meeting and then you hand.
So they gave him actually a gold whistle. So I don't know who on earth has a solid gold whistle, which we have. And then the other thing which they did was when the collection was made when he retired, and the J.H. Subbachshob lecture was inaugurated for each of these meetings in the.
Well, I think they must by now.
Must have run out of money by now.
Because this was international, sort of international.
Well, I think you obviously, what mining engineers' loss was as it came to the world of genetics, I think you've done much better than you would have done as a mining engineer.
I think you might be right there.
So he was obviously wrong.
The idea of, I don't know, this man just wanted to fill certain places. He had no interest.
So anyway, it was only after he retired and Dorrit started that we went to the first one. Suddenly, he becomes a member outside of a Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And I think this was very good. The other thing was that while he was working, people said, "You speak very good German. Where did you learn it?" And he'd said, "School." Which, of course, is correct, but not giving away too much.
Well, it just depends who.
And the children always used to make fun of him. As
yeah.
I can remember Bernard Wasserstein's parents telling us the lovely story. She was called to the telephone, and when she came back, the eldest one, the others were in the bath, and the eldest one was standing there imitating his mother You will get out of the bath, now! Our children always used to say, Dad, why does Dad say finger and not finger? What were the other things they always laugh? And the other thing is we have one or two words which are Austrian, which we use, and automatically kukuruts, which is maize, sweet corn, palachinke, which is pancakes.
It's in Hungarian as well. My
that's right. That's right.
Don't forget the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You asked about Jewish, and obviously most of my colleagues and people in the institute all known that I'm Jewish. However, nobody ever said anything that I could in any way regard as hinting at some problem. The only time that I have come across it on one occasion was quite different. You know, I had, as the director of the institute, I had to got a number of visitors at different times, and I took them to lunch and showed them around the institute and so on. And there was one retired chap, he had a cardiac problem. I don't even remember his name exactly anymore, who kept on asking questions. And he said, how come I couldn't find your name in the medical directory in the list? I said, I'm not there, but if you're interested, well, how come you become the director? I said, I was just taking him back from the lunch. I said, okay, I'll let you know. I took him into my office where my secretary said to Mary, just get the who's who and get my entry from the who's who and give it to a doctor.
John has always had tremendous loyalty from his staff. He's had four secretaries. We keep up with all of them. And they all think he's absolutely wonderful, you know.
It's been a pleasure.
No, it's been extremely interesting and incredibly impressive, actually.